From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. 40-year-old Efrain De La Rosa, a detainee at ICE's Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, was found dead in his cell last Tuesday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials say the preliminary cause of death was self-inflicted strangulation. The case remains under investigation. A statement from ICE says, quote, "While any fatality in an ICE custody is unfortunate, deaths in ICE custody are rare," unquote. Human Rights Watch says that De La Rosa is the eighth person to die in an immigration detention center since October of last year. Well, we're looking into those cases with attorney Sarah Owings. She's from Owings Immigration Law. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you. Good
Thanks
to be
for
here.
Being here. Spencer Woodman, he's reported on the Stewart Detention Facility for The Intercept and for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He's on the line with us from New York. Hello, Spencer.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Spencer, what can you tell us about Efrain De La Rosa's death?
You know, I don't think there's been all that much released about it. We do know that he died in an isolation cell, I believe, on Tuesday of last week, or at least he, from the preliminary reports, it sounds like he was found presumably hanging in an isolation cell. And, you know, it can be noted that this is not the first time this has happened. About 15 months ago, another ICE detainee named Jean Jimenez Joseph was found at the Stewart Detention Center in solitary confinement in the same block of isolation cells, hanging. And he had also committed suicide. In his case, he was in isolation for 19 days before his death.
Sir, are there any rules governing use of solitary confinement or isolation in detention centers?
I believe that there are some internal policy memorandums. Those are always really hard to receive from ICE. So I don't know. I'm sure that they're going to say things along the lines of, we only use these in the most extreme situations. We'll use solitary confinement when it's for the protection of someone who, you know, might be at risk for violence or problems in the general population, that sort of thing. However, it seems like it's used a lot more than that. It's always really difficult to get this kind of information out of ICE. But from my clients, you know, we hear them refer to it. You know, ICE will say it's you know, solitary confinement, it's protective custody, it's isolation, it's segregation. I've heard clients say castigos, which means punishment. It's concerning about when and how this type of isolation is deployed.
Spencer, you have done research and reporting specifically on solitary confinement or the use of restrictive confinement at the Stewart facility. What have you found?
Sure. And, you know, just by way of context, I mean, solitary confinement is, by international standards, widely considered to be torture if prolonged. And at, you know, I first got interested in the use of solitary at Stewart Detention Center about 2 years ago when I obtained logs detailing why ICE used solitary against hundreds of detainees at several detention centers around the country. And Stewart actually really stood out as a place where solitary confinement was used against detainees heavily. These logs showed that, you know, in some cases, solitary was being used to punish relatively minor seeming infractions, such as involving horseplay. And notably, a lot of people were being put in solitary confinement at Stewart for hunger striking. And this kind of opened up a window into something else that was happening at the facility, which was detainees just kind of going on hunger strike left and right to protest conditions at the facility, and also to ask for fairly modest seeming things like a meeting with their deportation officer, their ICE officer. In a lot of cases, it appears that the bureaucracy through which detainees have access to the mechanisms of justice had really broken down at the facility. And, you know, I should note that all of that these logs pertained to all of this that I'm describing so far happened during the last year of the Obama administration.
I see. Okay. So, Sarah, you have clients at the Stewart Detention Center. Do immigrant detainees have the same rights as U.S. citizens? You know, Eighth Amendment, does that apply to detainees? Can they be detained without having spoken to a lawyer or denied request to speak to a lawyer?
Yeah, so the Constitution does apply to people in the immigration context, right? But as far as the detention mechanisms and the way that civil detention works, it gets a lot more murky. People can be subjected to mandatory detention, not because they have been found guilty of a crime, simply because of the nature of their status. Like if you're stopped at the border seeking entry to the United States, you're not yet admitted, then you're an arriving alien, therefore you're subject to mandatory detention. And a judge doesn't have the power to release you from custody immediately. That doesn't mean that you are a threat to national security, to your neighborhood, to anyone, or that you're even a flight risk, but you may be stuck there for quite a while.
So they are treated, in effect, as criminals.
Yes. It's an interesting thing that under the Obama administration originally, I remember I started practicing around 2006. And so, you know, 2007, 2008, we start to see these changes once Obama comes in and they're saying we're going to have more tender detention mechanisms for people. But that really didn't happen. Through privatized detention, we have these sort of medium security federal facilities that get like built out in these really remote areas like Stewart, which is about 2.5 hours from downtown Atlanta. And then they get leased to the government. And that's just an attractive business deal. It's attractive for people that build those facilities. It's cheap land. It's attractive to, your congressional reps that are in the areas where these things are located. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to bring jobs in.
Right.
And so this process continues.
That's Sarah Owings. She's an immigration attorney at Owings Immigration Law. We're also speaking with Spencer Woodman. He's a reporter for, among other outlets, The Intercept, where he's done some reporting on the Stewart Detention Center that is here in Lumpkin, Georgia. Stewart, has ICE been cooperative in, you said you obtained logs. Have they been helpful or cooperative in your investigations of especially solitary confinement?
I mean, they've been cooperative to the extent that they complied with Freedom of Information Act regulations in handing these logs over to me in the first place. They haven't given much information. I mean, beyond that, when I've asked for comment,
And do they acknowledge use of solitary confinement?
So every time I do one of these stories, I get into what I find to be kind of a silly argument with especially CoreCivic, their contractor that runs the facility. CoreCivic has repeatedly told me that they do not use solitary confinement at Stewart or any other facility that they run. They use the kind of industry preferred term with a softer connotation of restrictive housing. I would argue that restrictive housing isn't very descriptive because all housing in a detention center is highly restrictive. So, I asked ICE and CoreCivic to prove that they don't use solitary confinement by sending me photos of the cells. They refused to do so. So I actually obtained a set of photos depicting basically from every angle, their solitary cells at Stewart. I obtained that from a Georgia Bureau of Investigation case file into a suicide that happened in that solitary block last year.
What did the cell look like?
And it was just a solitary confinement cell. There's no other interpretation. It's a tiny cell with no... it's furnished with a bed that stretches from one end to the other, a sink, and a shelf next to the, it's a square cell, a tiny square cell with a bath, with a toilet, a sink, and a bed. There is one window there's one window in the big, there's a big metal door with one window that is both covered with, metal mesh and also a glass. So the level of isolation is certainly severe, and I showed the photos to this special rapporteur for the UN on torture, who said, yeah, I mean, that's obviously solitary confinement. That cell is not suitable by international standards for anyone for more than a few hours. So I think in my opinion, the attempt to tell me that I would mislead the public by saying this is solitary confinement, by calling this solitary confinement, is it's just a PR strategy. This is a private company that to which its reputation is very important to get contracts and make a profit. So
I want to note that we did ask CoreCivic about this, which manages and owns private prisons and detention centers, including Stewart Detention Facility. We asked for a comment. They replied in an email saying, quote, that they are cooperating fully with officials investigating the death of Mr. De La Rosa. Due to the active investigation, it would be premature to comment beyond the information released by our government partner, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, Office of Public Affairs, unquote. Sarah, give us a bigger picture of this. Are ICE detention centers around the country, many of them are privately operated? How much money, do we have any idea of how much money private prisons are making, private prisons companies are making off of these detention centers?
A lot. It is a $1 billion industry. Absolutely. I think for fiscal year 2019, President Trump has requested 52,000 detention beds. That's up from about 38,000, which is where it's been for the last few years. This year, of course, well, since he came into office, it's gone up. For those 52,000 beds, it's going to cost about $2.8 billion. And a lot of that money goes to private detention centers.
So what are the people that you're speaking to, your clients there at Stewart and other detention facilities, what are they saying? What are they concerned about?
I mean, they're always miserable. It's not a good place to be. A lot of them are fighting for their lives. They're seeking asylum. They're fleeing all kinds of violence around the world. Or they've maybe gotten into trouble here in Georgia, and they're being held away from their families in these remote areas. The complaints range the gamut. It's always complaints about the food, about inability to communicate with the outside world. I mean, you're in a really isolated detention center, but it's also in a place of isolation because it's so far away from the general population of the area. And it's hard. It's hard to get attorney visitation sometimes. There's only like three little sort of rooms to meet people. And when you go to Stewart Detention Center after you drive down there, and it's hard to hear people over the little telephones that they give you. You can barely make eye contact based on where they're located on opposite sides of the wall. You kind of meet people at like a diagonal angle, and that just kind of sums up the whole process, the way that we interact with our clients.
Okay. Well, Human Rights Watch is counting. They've mm-hmm. counted 8 suicides so far in these facilities. Where is the investigation going from here?
Where is it going from here? That's okay. No, I don't know. I'm sure that there will be the internal investigation through OPR, and there's, I'm sure, attorneys looking into this. I'm not on this particular case, but people do care a great deal, and HRW, SCIFI, which is the Southeast Immigrant Freedom Initiative through Southern Poverty Law Center, all those groups care a great deal.
Well, Sarah, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Owings is from Owings Immigration Law, and also Spencer Woodman from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, the life and legacy of the late global icon Nelson Mandela. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it is Mandela Day. Each year on July 18th, the life, work, and memory of Nelson Mandela is honored. Fans globally are invited to do 67 minutes of service in memory of Mandela's 67-year battle for social justice. Today would have been his 100th birthday, and President Barack Obama appeared in Johannesburg, South Africa, yesterday to commemorate the occasion.
Yes, by the end of his life, Madiba embodied the successful struggle for human rights. But that journey was not easy. It wasn't preordained. The man went to prison for almost 3 decades.
Nelson Mandela died in 2013. We're getting a personal reminiscence of the great man's life and times with On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen, who lived in South Africa for 20 years. Hello, Fenley.
Hi, Virginia.
And Joe Richmond is on the line. He's in Cape Cod. He's the Radio Diaries founder and executive producer. He lived in South Africa and documented the life of Mandela in a series of radio specials. Hello, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. What a day. Tell us what South Africa was like when you came to the country, Fenley, back in what, which year?
So we arrived along with my parents and my brother in February 1993. So this was the scenario back then. Mandela was already out of prison. So he had come out of prison in February 11, 1990. The National Party was in power. So the National Party was for mainly the ethnic Afrikaans people, which is of people of Dutch descent. So no people of color was part of that party. It was just plainly the Dutch people. And the president was F.W. de Klerk. And during that time, there was so much negotiations going on between Mandela and F.W. de Klerk on how to, the transition of power.
Right.
So lots of conversations going on behind closed doors.
And actually, they won the Nobel Peace Prize together, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes. So F.W. de Klerk and Nelson Mandela won the Nobel Peace Prize. But the interesting part of that whole thing is, although they shared the stage together, they had a very strained relationship. Because you can imagine during the conversations, Mandela's going, you've got to give us full power. And then, F.W. de Klerk obviously was trying to keep some of that. And he Mandela was not negotiating on that level. He wanted full control of the reins of the country.
And Joe, I welcome you to chime in if there's anything you hear about what Fenley's saying from her experience, because you were there for a long time and you studied his life. And there's so much that we hear about him being freed from prison, not as much about how he got there. Why was he thrown in jail initially?
Well, I mean, he was an activist from very early on, even before he arrived in Johannesburg. I think a lot of people start, when they talk about the history of apartheid, they start it sort of in 1948 when the Afrikaner Party, the National Party, took power. But, of course, it wasn't like oppression of blacks started in 1948. The British government was oppressive as well. And so it's been a long-running battle, and Mandela was part of what was the Youth League of the ANC, which has been more of a militant side of the ANC at that point.
Well, go ahead, Fenley.
Sorry, and it was called Umkhonto weSizwe, the military wing of the ANC, the Youth League, basically. He headed that up. And also prior to that, he actually attended Fort Hare University. And during that time, he was expelled from university because he led student protests. So this was all part of what he's always done.
Well, here's an early recording that, Joe, you used in an audio history of Mandela. Here is Mandela responding to the National Party winning the elections.
I remember I came out of Park Station that morning and bought a newspaper and learned that the National Party had won. And Comrade Oliver Tambo said, well, I like this because we now know that we have an enemy in power. And I think that we're going to have a better opportunity of mobilizing our people.
Fenley, why is that an important conversation, knowing that?
Well, it was important because that's how he was able to mobilize people. He wanted people to know, especially black South Africans, that there is an enemy in power and they are not looking after your rights. You must remember, black people in South Africa was under the Bantu education, which means that they weren't getting the full education that everyone else in the country was getting. There was so many segregation laws, like the Morality Act, where you cannot have an affair with a person of color, the prohibition of mixed marriages. They were totally suppressed. So when that moment happened, Mandela thought, okay, this is a great time to mobilize my people towards freedom. He wanted a unified South Africa, not that one that's just for white people, but one for all.
So he knew early on there was a lot of discontent. What was it about him that was able to sort of gather people around him and mobilize them? Joe, any thoughts on that?
I was just going to say, just to chime in before, that it's interesting to note that the system of apartheid actually didn't start back at that point in 1948. It was an evolution. So the word and the idea of apartheid started with President Verwoerd a little bit later. And that was, it was always a bit, Mandela was really kind of a genius strategist in terms of public opinion. And that was really one of his strengths. And I think, that clip and the idea of having a more visible kind of an enemy that you could really see and get people to galvanize around was really important to him, yes. And that was his strength.
So this was there was an opportunism. There was a strategic nature to him, certainly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and it was not his first arrest when he was thrown in jail. He was arrested in December 5th, 1956, acquitted in March 29th, 1961, then arrested again and went to trial. Here's a recording that you found from that trial. This was in 1963, and he took the stand.
I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
An idea for which I am prepared to die. Did all South Africans hear this?
Of course. I mean, not at the time. I mean, Joe could answer more to that.
Joe, what do you think?
It's really, I mean, that speech, it's so interesting about that speech because it's called now, it's called often the I am prepared to die speech because those five words are so well known. But there are actually 10,693 words in the speech.
So it's a long
speech.
Testimony.
And just to get a picture of what's happening here, this is the seven defendants in the Rivonia trial. Many people thought they would be executed, so they were prepared to die. And here he is standing up, giving a four-hour speech to the judge, saying, "I am prepared to die." And it's it says something about the man just in the delivery of that moment. And I think that speech won a lot of, it got a lot of attention, and there was a lot of press in terms of, worldwide press paying attention to this trial. And a lot of people kind of see that speech as the moment that he really became the Nelson Mandela that we know. Mm. And it's interesting just about the speech itself because, like a lot of recordings at that time, they were just either erased or, over the years or lost.
Where'd you find it?
Well, that speech was found by an employee of SABC, the public broadcaster, after the transition, and it was on these plastic Dictabelt recordings. There were only three of these Dictabelt players in the world at the time. Mm-hmm. So they had to work with the British Library in London, and they had to figure out how to, get this thing to play. And that was how this speech was salvaged, and we were able to find it and use it. But at that time, there were all these recordings that people were sort of there was part of the trial recording that I was able to find in the library that I had to tape together with splicing tape to hear it. And that was just a moment where all these kind of lost and potentially erased recordings were being preserved. And, the fact that we have that speech today is really a fluke of history.
It makes me think of the letter from a Birmingham jail, that coalescing moment, right?
Yeah.
That's Joe Richman. He's executive producer and founder of Radio Diaries. Among the things he does is find amazing pieces of tape like that for radio specials. Fenley Foxen is also with me. She's a producer here at On Second Thought, and she lived in South Africa for a long time, knows a lot about the life and legacy of Mandela. And Fenley, I want to put that question to you. These strong ideals, I'm prepared to die. Seven other defendants in the room, and he's the one who says that. Where did that come from him?
Well, you must understand the setting of that day. I mean, they've been so oppressed. I mean, Mandela, the black South Africans, totally oppressed, tortured, taken to prisons. The police would just knock on your doors, will barge into your house and arrest you and take you for torture. And I mean, they're living under terrible, terrible conditions. They have no access to water, sanitation. It's just a very cruel system that apartheid is. So you either want to die for that or do you want to live like that? I think that was his thinking. And he thought he can take this forward and say, well, I don't want to live like this, but at least if I die, I go under almost like in glory. One's going to forget Mandela. They will know him for someone who died for something he believed in. And that was very important to him.
Yeah, powerful stuff. Well, let's hear a little bit that later he remembered being flown to Robben Island where he was in prison. Let's hear a little clip of that.
As we're being flown to Robben Island, one tried to accept the reality that we may, in fact, spend years in prison. But we believed very strongly that we would not die in jail.
Joe, do you think that Mandela's power grew when he was in prison?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, you know, that it's important to remember is that at this time when he was sent to Robben Island, he was considered, called a terrorist, not just by the South African government, but by our government, the American government. I mean, he was considered, even up through the 80s, a terrorist. And so, you know, it's just important to remember just how he was seen. But what happened in prison, you know, they thought that by putting him in prison, you know, no photographs of him, no recordings of his voice, they thought he would just lock away not just the man, but what he meant. And the opposite happened. You know, he became so mythical in prison. And one of the fortunate things about putting him in prison for the movement was that he was able to be there and his hands didn't get bloody. He didn't make mistakes. He was able to be kind of preserved in amber through what was very, you know, very complicated and bloody battle for many years. So he really was able to become this myth in prison, and his reputation and his meaning only grew.
And in the meantime, international sentiment did eventually shift. A lot of external pressure, or international pressure, against the apartheid system. In the end, why finally was he released on the 11th of December, February rather, in 1990?
Well, eventually, I think F.W. de Klerk got into conversations with Mandela and decided, you know, it's time to hand the power to basically phase out in the National Party. But you must remember, in 1985, South African president at the time, P.W. Botha, he had gone to Mandela and said, when Mandela was in prison, he had said to him, look, I can free you. Just tell your people to stop being so violent outside, because there was so much unrest in the country. The Umkhonto weSizwe, which is the ANC military wing, was already taking to the streets and fighting against the oppression. And Winnie Mandela would visit Mandela in Winnie Mandela is Mandela's ex-late wife, and she would visit him in prison and understand what it is that he's thinking and take it back to the streets for the people. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this was already happening, and Mandela said to P.W. Botha, he said, I will not come out of prison until my people or apartheid is completely ended. Once that ends, I will come out. So
standing firm on
principle. Standing firm. I mean, he was going to stay in prison and he was okay with that. Mm. And eventually, of course, they negotiated and Mandela was released by F.W. de Klerk.
Yes. Released, rewrote the constitution, became the first black president of South Africa on the 10th of May in 1994. You were there, Fenley. What did that mean to black and to white South Africa?
Oh, wow. When Mandela took power for black people, it was a moment of glorious emancipation. I mean, this, they've never seen a black leader in power. They have never seen someone take the center stage as he did at that moment in time. For white people, initially it was a time of a lot of fear. They weren't sure where this was headed. I remember people saying, well, I'm going to move to Australia. I don't know what's going to happen. But Mandela had this amazing, amazing ability to unify the nation by just saying the right things, and people believed in him in what he said.
Well, that's a question. Joe, you talked about him being sort of preserved in amber, but when you are actually governing inspirational figures, you can make mistakes. So he was a great, a venerated, gracious, elegant, and strong figure, but was he a good president?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's sort of two factors. You know, going back to his release, you know, part of it was, the thinking was, let's release him and he's just going to be seen as this old, frail, fallible man, and they'll demythologize him. That was a part of the thinking of releasing him, because he had become such a powerful symbol in prison. And they got that part wrong. You know, he became a more powerful figure once he was released. You know, the ability to kind of bring this transition, to make this happen in a peaceful way, which no one expected. But yes, as president, I think Mandela himself talked about, you know, I don't think anyone thought that was his strength, to actually govern. He was, you know, I think one of the amazing things he did as president was to only stay for 4 years, term. And that was something that he did intentionally and always said. And, you know, he talked about his own failings as president. AIDS was a real heartache for him in later years, that he did so little about AIDS in his country for his 4 years. But also, I have to say, when you look at the presidents who have followed him, you know, he sort of shines in relation to the presidents who followed him in South Africa.
Yeah, hard act to follow, certainly. Fanny?
I just want to add to that. I mean, straight after his presidency, when he became a president, in 1995, we had the South African rugby. And rugby at that time was predominantly a white sport. So your stadiums are full of white people. Your players are mainly white people. I think there was just one black player. And when South Africa won that World Cup in 1995 against the All Blacks, which is your New Zealand team, Mandela came down and shook hands with Francois Pienaar, who was the captain at the time. He even wore the same jersey as the captain, Francois Pienaar, which was number 6. I remember that moment so clearly watching it. It was a moment that unified the whole nation. Black people were proud. White people were proud. Everyone was proud. And Mandela was actually at the helm of it.
You know, that was one of his amazing qualities, was this understanding symbolism that way. You know, there are a few examples. There was this famous example where he had tea with all of the widows of the ex-presidents of the National Party. And there's another example when he got out of prison, how he addressed the negotiations with his enemy. He talked to them in Afrikaans. And, you know, this sort of understanding how to kind of, deflate your opponent and kind of, in a way, it's such a lesson
Joe,
for our time now.
I'm sorry I have to wrap you up there, but a beautiful way to stop. Thank you so much for joining us, Joe Richman.
Thank you.
And Fenley Foxon.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. When the official portrait of Michelle Obama was unveiled at the National Gallery, artist Amy Sherald talked about her inspiration for that Millie dress.
It has an abstract pattern that reminded me of the Dutch artist Piet Mondrian's geometric paintings. But Millie's design also resembles the inspired quilt masterpieces made by the women of Gee's Bend, a small, remote black community in Alabama where they compose quilts and geometries that transform clothes and fabric remnants into masterpieces.
Gee's Bend is a remote peninsula in Wilcox County, surrounded on three sides by the Alabama River. In their isolation, generations of women descended from slaves created a visual language, a world apart from the ordered symmetry valued in other quilting traditions. Discarded clothes, worn jeans, corduroy, and as one quilter put it, old raggedy cloth, are transformed into bold geometric forms and improvised stripes, created oftentimes as the women sang spirituals.
A lonely graveyard, many miles away, lies your dear old mother beneath the cold clay.
Born of practicality, poverty, and community custom, the Quilts of Gee's Bend became a blockbuster art show in museums across the country. New York Times art critic Michael Kimmelman wrote after seeing the show in 2002, "Imagine Matisse and Clay arising not from rarefied Europe, but from the caramel soil of the rural South in the form of women, descendants of slaves, when Gee's Bend was a plantation." Louisiana Bendolph is one of those women.
Quilting is just like, you know, it's something you inherit. And at first I didn't look at it that way. And I think that's why you think of something that your parents done and you say, you know, kids like to follow what their parents do sometime. And so quilting is kind of like passed down because of the desire to do it and the need to do it. That's why I kept on going.
These days, many of the quilters are elderly and don't get out much. But I'll be speaking with Louisiana Bendolph for Air Serenby's Speaking of Making series tonight at the Atlanta History Center at 7:30. It is a rare chance to hear a truly original American artist. I'm not going to promise singing, but I'll leave you with this recording from the Sacred Songs of Gee's Bend.
One day I'm going home. Yes, Lord.
Ruby Vail and the Soulphonics released a new album, The State of All Things, this spring. The Atlanta-based band has carved out a beloved place as a rollicking soul and R&B ensemble.
lost tribes of our past lingering in waves. Silently, but I can sense them rolling in their graves. They echo disdainful how we've lost our way. The earth and all her power shakes under the weight. Will those we leave behind learn from
our... That is State of All Things. Ruby Vell and the Soulphonics playing live at the GPB studios. And Ruby is now in the studio with me. Hello.
Oh, GPB, Atlanta and beyond. How are we?
We're great. Really glad to hear you. And thank you so much for coming into play for us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here today.
So, Vell, is that real name?
Vell is a stage name.
All right. Where'd it come from?
Well, I didn't want to overthink things. So many years ago when I started out in college, I had just come from high school days where I dated a really swell guy, but he had this amazing 69 Chevelle car. And so that car never left my mind. And I just said to myself, you know, I've always wanted this career in music. So when I quote unquote make it, I will get my Chevelle. I know Killer Mike's got a few that he could probably, you know, loan me for the moment, but I'll get there one day.
So you don't have the Chevelle yet?
No, but I just wanted, you know, not to overthink a stage name. So that's where it came from.
A muscle car.
Yeah, an American muscle car. And it's a Canadian East Indian woman.
Yeah, so tell me about that. I'm trying to understand how a Canadian East Indian woman came to love soul music.
I was introduced to a lot of the music that I love and that I've built this career off of just from being around my aunt and uncle. They were of Liverpudlian descent.
That's a good pedigree for music.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Beatles in your backyard. So from a very young age, they exposed me to things like Marvin Gaye, Aretha Franklin, Etta James, even Al Di Meola. I mean, you name it, Curtis Mayfield, all sorts of artists. So at a young age, I was enamored with this sound, with the bass really is what initially brought me to it. And then the use of the voice. You know, once you find people like Minnie Riperton, Martha Reeves, Linda Lindell, all of these people were just magic to me. And I had to know how to make that sound come out of this body. And so that was many, many years ago now, but early influences were all through families playing records.
Did your parents, who were from of Punjab descent, immigrants to Toronto, was it?
That's right, yes.
What were they listening to?
My parents were listening to pretty much everything Bollywood, early 1950s music, which harkens to a lot of Italian music at that time, too. I see a lot of similarities with the cinema music that was coming out. But they also were influenced by my aunt and uncle. So my dad was really into Hendrix, really into Queen, absolutely loved Freddie Mercury. Everywhere I looked, there was just the era of 60s, 70s, classic era of music just seeping into my bones.
So if I listen to you, I can close my eyes and it's, you know, 1966 and everything's black and white. It is really an amazing thing with that band, that the Soulphonics that you play with, you know, bumping horn section with all these hooks.
Yeah, and amazing.
Just driving the music. But it doesn't seem, to you, is it nostalgic?
No, to me, it's ancient meets modern. To me, it's just another breath of, you know, the beat. It's just another measure. And we just tell it the way we know how to tell it. I think from being kind of straddled across multiple cultures, it's allowed me to adapt in ways to the music and also to the commentary of the lyricism that does kind of cross bridges and break boundaries.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the lyricism, because State of All Things, I mean, that contains a lot.
It absolutely does. Maybe all that there is.
Well, that's a very big umbrella. So in that song, you are talking about the world as it is. This is not a, you know, a boy meets girl love song.
Mm.
Tell me what inspired that.
The first lines of the song, lost tribes of our past lingering in waves. Silently, but I can sense them rolling in their graves. It's like hearkening back to, you know, how we got things really wrong, how our ancestors might be a little put off by everything that's happening right now. And then on the flip side, to see it as well, there's unity and there's this condition, and we're all in this together as one loving condition of the human race. So it offers a little bit of upliftment as well to see, you know, unity beyond all.
So we heard a little from that song. Let's hear a little bit of Who Closed the Book.
Yes.
And I come no other way but how I am, and nothing you say could never, ever, ever mend these false words of love. This chapter's done, done, done. I throw my hands up.
That's my guest, Ruby Vell, singing. Ruby Vell and the Soulphonics are out with a fairly recent record, State of All Things. And they're playing that, and they played that song live for us at the GPB studios. There's another video that I watched of you singing an Otis Redding song. This was at the Stax at 60, I think, Celebration Indicator.
That's right. We did a tribute to their 60th birthday as a record label.
Let's hear just a little bit from that.
Oh, wonderful.
Ruby Vell, you're killing it in that song.
Thank you. That was a labor of love, that show, you know, to uphold the fabric of what we're doing, and to really give respect to the legacy that is Stax. You know, I think both bands are kind of seamless in their work, or that label and our band is kind of seamless in that mission.
Well, I'm thinking of you singing an Otis Redding song, you know. What are you tapping into when you pull out that classic soul?
For me, it's just something that I've always thought comes directly from my heart. So there's not a whole lot of overthinking. I really truly believe every culture has its form of soul music. You have ragas in Indian classical music. You have Urdu lyricism, you know, and Sufi poetry and things of that nature. That's soul music too, you know. So I think there is that ability to tap into these different emotions. And I think soul music is just that. It's just a conduit for how do we tell our story, take our snapshot of the state of all things, if you will, and what kind of emotions are wrapped up in within all that.
I once heard a woman speaking about the power of radio, which, of course, that's something I think a lot about. But one of the things that she said is that there are theories about the civil rights movement actually being fed by soul music because, you know, it was coming out of these big clear channels all the way across the country. So all these people who had never met an African-American were hearing their music and sort of tapping into what they were saying. And that gave them a sense of empathy that they would not have had otherwise. And so that was one of the groundswells of support, which is stunning.
You're absolutely right. And I have a beautiful story to reflect that in my in-laws, you know, born outside of Mississippi, growing up through all of this, you know, 50s, 60s era atrocities. And so in love with everything that Benny King's doing, everything that the Funk Brothers are doing, what Motown's doing. He often sends covers my way even today. So that reverence, that respect, it could only be brought from strife and struggle and a perilous kind of path. So America has walked that path, and here we are going down a similar path. So we thought, hey, let's give you a soundtrack to to make you think and to make you move a little bit. I think that's a mission of ours.
So you married someone from Mississippi?
No, I married an Atlantan-born AT alien.
But your family were they sort of strict Punjab, traditional? Because I know people that I have known who are Indian American, for example, their parents really they really were against them marrying somebody outside of their own ethnicity.
My parents were, I would say, equal parts strict traditionalists and then also equal parts freedom fighters, just like me. But growing up, you know, they couldn't always tell that to us. But I eventually fought for the freedoms I needed to develop my art. It just took a very long time. And there was ideas, conceptions, notions, programming, you name it, you know, in the way. But those are all just obstacles that every artist faces along their journey. And mine came in the form of my parents not always getting it, appreciating it, knowing what it was. But that was part of the journey. I wrote several songs about that, Feet on the Ground being one of them.
When did you start writing songs?
Really, when I met Spencer Garn and Scott Clayton, my two business partners in the Soulphonics, that was the time that I really started to take what I knew as poetry that I was writing in my teens and into my early 20s and start crafting it into some songs. And, you know, probably 100 bad ones came out before anything decent, but I just decided to not give up and to see it through. And eventually it started to be more of a, how can we tell a collective story of benefit? How can we tell just collective story of our culture, our times, through song?
So you were that girl writing in her poems in her journal when you were growing
up. So incredibly, embarrassingly emotional.
Do you ever look back at them now, what you were writing?
Yes, I absolutely have all of them kept. They're in a plastic bin in my house, undisclosed place in my house. And yeah, along with some of the first singles that I ever recorded when I was 16, you know, cover songs, but I do keep them to just say, yeah, there was times where all I could write about was heartbreak, and I thought that's all that anybody cared about, and now I'm realizing that there's a whole spectrum of stories to be told.
What were the cover songs? I'm curious.
Oh, I did. My first song ever recorded was a Tamia cover song. She was an R&B artist from the 90s.
Yes,
yeah. Oh,
yes,
we got
yes,
the 90s
Tamia,
fans in the house.
We got some big thumbs up
yes,
for Tamia.
I Am So Into You. That was a really great song, but only done with a soprano range because that's literally all I had when I started out. So I've had to work pretty hard to get here, at least.
That is maybe a perfect point to leave with the song Way Back When. Hearing a little bit about how it was for Ruby Vail.
Historically, it seems that I haven't been the best news. I wonder if you always knew I'd kill the love we grew.
Ruby Vail and the Soulphonics' new album is called The State of All Things. They're going to be playing at Bragg Jam in Macon on July 28th. There's more on the show and more on the music at gpbnews.org.
Pretending like everything would be just fine.
And Ruby Vail reminds us that while we honor the past, we do our best work firmly planted where we are in the present. And we at On Second Thought are committing to that this summer. When I arrived in Atlanta 2 months ago, I plunged in as host to avoid disrupting service to GPB's audience. Now it's summer, and we're taking a break to spend some time getting to know more about our listeners. I'm setting out to learn about your life in Georgia. What kind of issues do you think about? What do you talk about with your neighbors and want to hear or not from your statewide public radio network? Well, you have a place in creating a show that connects to real life in Georgia. And we want you to call us with your suggestions, where I should go, who I should meet. We're at 404-500-9457, or leave your thoughts on our Facebook page or on Twitter at OST Talk. Terry Gross is going to be in this spot tomorrow with Fresh Air. On Second Thought, we'll be back in September. I'm Virginia Prescott. On behalf of producers Fenley Foxen, The Raven Taylor, Summer Evans, Leighton Rowell, and our engineer Tyler Morris, stay cool and stay tuned for even more ways to join the conversation.
Away, away. Ooh, I've grown accustomed to